What I'm focusing on is the work of an Italian woman who lived at the beginning of the 17th century. And her name is Artemisia Gentileschi. And I'll put her name on the screen. There was an exhibit. I can't remember the date. I think it's about 1975, a major exhibit called Women in Art from 1550 to 1950. And in that exhibit, there were six paintings by this woman, Artemisia Gentileschi. And that exhibit caused a lot of women art historians to start asking questions about the way people wrote the history of art. And we all have our professional organizations. We go to our conventions, and my professional organization is called the College Art Association of America. And we usually meet in New York or Washington, sometimes in LA. And in 1978, and I went to that conference in New York City, a group of women formed an organization called Caucus for Women in the Arts. And they commissioned a series of papers called Questioning the Litany. And what I'm talking about today is really based very much on one of the papers that was presented at that conference by a woman named Mary Girard. And she worked on the theme of Susanna and the Elders, which is an interesting theme. I wish I had more examples of the way this theme has been treated by artists in the Renaissance and Baroque period. That's the 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th century. It's a very strong theme. I only have a couple of examples, but I think I can say what I need to say about the theme. At any rate, it's a very important image for Artemisia, and I'll explain why, because I want to go into her biography. It's quite interesting and quite tragic, and it shows how personal her painting was. And she emerges as a distinct female personality through her work. And she wasn't born in the latter part of the 20th century when the feminist movement began. But one can imagine that because of what happened to her, deep down in her inside, in her subjectivity, emerged some notions about a male-dominated world. And that's partly what I want to talk about today. I'd like to just go back and talk about the importance of sight and vision and seeing. We believe that children recognize things before they understand the words, before they can say the name. Their first contact with the world is through their eyes. And they develop this rich experience visually of the world around them. And then they take that information and make it a part of themselves, part of their deep down subjectivity. They feel what it feels like to feel that way. And ultimately, these kinds of feelings turn into concepts or words. And then they can start talking about them, but that talking about things comes quite a bit later. And artists are involved in a dynamic relationship of who they are as a person and their materials, their paintbrush, their canvas, or their marble, or their chisels, or whatever their medium is. The subject matter that they're working with, a bowl of apples, a crucifixion, Napoleon, George Washington crossing the Delaware, and also things that are part of the wiring diagram of their community, things that their world believes in or thinks is important. And all of these things go into a dynamic relationship if the artist really gets involved in his work or her work. In this case, we're talking about a woman. And you can't really separate out the paint from the subject matter, from the artist's biography, from the values of the community that this person belongs to. And maybe the artist is criticizing values in the community without even being aware of it. And so it's hard to say how intentional Artemisia's work is. Does she really know what she's doing? Or is this Monday morning quarterbacking from the 20th century, looking back at what she did? I don't think it really matters. I think we talked a little bit about that last night. I don't think it matters that the artist doesn't completely understand what is trying to be said. And it's legitimate for us to go within certain limitations. It's legitimate for us, I think, to criticize the work, to interpret it, to enter into it, to tell the artist things that the artist doesn't even know are there. We all do things that surprise us. We make a loaf of bread and then we eat it. We can't believe that we made that loaf of bread. At least I can if I ever was successful. My bread, if I drop it on the floor, it goes through the floorboards down into the basements. And I do the same things that Bobby does when she makes bread, but hers turns out light and fluffy. I don't know why mine doesn't come out, but it must be something about the way I was toilet trained or something. It's just, I don't understand. Well, I'm getting ridiculous. The story of Susanna and the elders is an apocryphal, it's from the apocryphal text of the Bible. And it was attached to the 13th chapter of the book of Daniel by the Council of Trent. There is a Daniel involved in the story of Susanna and the elders, but it's not the same Daniel probably as the Daniel of the Old Testament, the book of the Bible. And later on it was recognized as possibly apocryphal. And we don't know exactly where the theme developed. There are folk tales that are very close to the story of Susanna and the elders. And possibly it was a kind of allegorical way of talking about some conflicts between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. It's believed that the story was written about 120 AD. So it's not a part of the Bible as we know it today, but it was a very important theme in the history of art. And it's a theme about a real three-dimensional, solid, magnificent woman heroine, a woman of tremendous stature and strength. But in the history of art, that quality never comes through. Susanna is married to Joachim, and the elders, I assume the elders of the tribe or the elders of the church or the elders of their community get together and decide they want to get involved with Susanna. Joachim is out of town or out in the fields. And so they go to her place, to her house. And she's observed taking a bath. And these lecherous old men, plot to seduce her. And here in this scene by Tintoretto in the 16th century, which we saw briefly last time, we see the old man peeking around behind this bower of flowers, this wall of flowers. This man peeking over here, and another man over here. And Susanna is a very voluptuous figure. I'm sure you'd all agree with that. And she has her one foot in the water, and she's barely covered by this cloth that she's drying herself with. We talked last night about the presence of the mirror, and I suggested that that was a way of legitimizing the men's voyeuristic act, peeking at the woman, and also our participation in that voyeurism by condemning Susanna for staring at herself in the mirror. Well, the problem is, the two old men say, "You submit to us, or we will denounce you in public." And she refuses. She says, "No, no way. I belong to Joachim." And they persist, and they put great pressure on her, tremendous pressure, and she resists, and she says, "No." And they tell her what will happen to her if she doesn't participate in this seduction scene. And she continues to say no. She's committed to her chastity and to her sexuality belongs to her husband, Joaquin. And so the old men go about destroying her in the public. And they talk about how she tried to seduce them and how she is an evil woman and how she should be stoned and got rid of. And ultimately, the case comes to the courts, and the judge happens to be Daniel, but it's not the Daniel of the book of the Old Testament. It's another Daniel, but the Council of Trent put them together. And Daniel judges against the men, against the elders, against these lecherous old men. And they are stoned to death publicly. Well, that aspect of the story is never told. There are a few representations of the execution of the judgment, but they're really hard to find. Rather, the way artists have used it in these four centuries, over and over and over again, is to talk about the adventure that these men are engaged in. And it's an adventure that leads to what can only be called rape. And so this is a painting about rape. And we all know that all men say that if a woman is raped, she was asking for it. And that seems to be the suggestion that's always present in this painting. The way Tintoretto presents Susanna, she is a voluptuous goddess. She's bedecked in pearls. Her foot is in the water. Water relates to the whole idea of Aphrodite. Aphrodite and Venus are born from the sea. The water is the bath. It's also the sea. It's also fertility. There is that suggestion of the female relationship to fertility. The flowers in the garden are lush symbols of eroticism. And so the artist tends to place this subject in this highly suggestive, highly erotic kind of environment. And so everything about it is designed to stimulate the passion and feeling of the men who are on this adventure. I don't know how they got the idea to do this, but they proceeded to carry it out. So, over and over again, the focus is not on the heroic quality of Susanna, but on what these men are doing and on this highly erotic environment, which suggests that she's asking for whatever she gets. There's no way that we can describe this painting as a biblical painting. It's a painting about male ego, about male conquest. And the whole history of art is filled with the subject of what's politely called abduction, but in reality, it's the subject of rape. It goes on over and over and over again. In the whole history of classical art, it's a major theme. Apollo and Zeus are constantly engaged in this activity. Jupiter abducts Europa, and there are all kinds of paintings about Europa riding off on the back of Jupiter, who comes in the guise of a bull. Jupiter and Io. Jupiter comes to Io as a cloud, and there are paintings of Jupiter embracing Io, and it always appears that Io and Europa really are enjoying the adventure. There's Jupiter and Ganymede, which is a homosexual kind of rape. Jupiter snatches up this little boy, carries him off into the heaven to satisfy himself. Again, except for Rembrandt made a painting where Ganymede is really, he's crying, he's terrorized, but generally speaking, it's a very pleasant little flight off into the heavens. Over and over again in the history of Western civilization, this theme appears, and it's always seen as an exciting adventure. And I think it's well known that military victory involves the right to rape the land and the people, to take what's rightfully yours. And what's rightfully yours is materials, gold, jewels, possessions, but also the women. And it's seen as an heroic act, and it's celebrated. Never do we see this from the point of view of the victim. from the point of view of the woman. I wished I, now that I'm here, I wish I could run back to my slide room and get Rembrandt's painting of Lucretia, which is in the Minneapolis Art Institute. A lot of you from Minneapolis probably know that painting. It's a painting I've grown up with from the first time my parents took me to the Art Institute. And so it, from my point of view, it seems to me to be the most powerful Rembrandt that was ever painted. But Lucretia is an exception to this whole celebration of male conquest as a very wonderful, exciting thing. In the Rembrandt painting of Lucretia, she has been violated by her neighbor. She is so deeply committed to her husband, and she feels like she's been spoiled and destroyed, and so she commits suicide. And in Rembrandt's painting, she has just withdrawn the knife, and she's sinking into this gigantic pile of kind of golden velvet drapery that surrounded her, that was her cloak. And she grabs this cord as she is about to pass out and die. And so in that case, in the Lucretia story, the focus is on the victim and not on the male. And in the Susanna story, it ought to be on the victim, but it never is, with the exception of Artemisia Gentileschi, whom we'll come to in a moment. The church father, the bishop of the church, who ultimately became a martyr in the 3rd century, Hippolytus, wrote about the Susanna theme, and he likened Susanna to Eve. And he made a comparison between the devil who lusted after Eve and the devil who entered into the lives of these elders, these two elder men, and lusted after Susanna. And we know that Eve capitulated to the devil, and there's a suggestion here that Susanna will capitulate to the elders. So even the church fathers in the 3rd century didn't talk about Susanna as a victim. They tended to make their case for the men involved. Let's look at one more example of this. I hope. Oh, there's a stuck slide there. This is Rembrandt, Susanna and the Elders. And obviously Rembrandt is, I'm a fan of Rembrandt, and Rembrandt can almost do no wrong. His values are consonant with, I think, most of ours. But this is his approach to the subject of Susanna and the Elders. Again, I wish I had a few dozen more that I could think of now that are more like the Tintoretto scene. But in a sense, Rembrandt is more sympathetic to the victim, but not quite. In a sense, Rembrandt's approach lets us have the subject both ways. Susanna is interrupted by the bath. Rembrandt is much more realistic, and these two old men are creeping down, and he's talking vigorously to her, and he's, as you can see, he's reaching to remove her garments. And she's obviously pained by this. She cringes. She looks out at us maybe for help or some way out of this situation. But in another sense, her pose suggests that she's covering up something. And covering up something calls attention to what's being covered up. So the pose of the figure, the way he organizes the figure, both suggests her repulsion, her anxiety, her fear, her terror, but at the same time, she takes the traditional pose of the goddess, the Venus figure. And there's a famous statue in the city of Florence called the Medici Venus, and it's called the Venus Pudica. It's the pose of modesty, where Venus barely covers her breasts and the genital area. But it's not really modest at all. Actually, it's very erotic. It's sort of like Mae West dancing with fans, and she teases us and covers herself with a fan. water's there, the garden. I don't know that it's as erotically suggestive as Tintoretto. But let's go to Artemisia. Her father's name is Orazio. I might just go back and say that there are very few women artists. There are a few before Artemisia, but they're very rare. We do know that women have always been involved in the fiber arts from the ancient days and on. Women made clothing and they made decorative tapestries and so on. We know that in the medieval world, women were involved in creating pyramids and liturgical garments, banners, because they had these natural skills working with fibers, or at least that was the tradition. We know that the famous Bayeux tapestry celebrating the Norman conquest was done perhaps by an army of 200 women weavers. So there is some tradition of anonymous women working in the visual arts. Possibly some women were employed as manuscript painters in the medieval world. But in more modern times, from the Renaissance and on, women are really excluded from the visual arts. And part of the problem is that women weren't trained properly. They weren't allowed to work in the presence of the model, the nude figure. And most of the commissions for paintings involved the human figure. And women didn't know how to do the figure, so they didn't get the jobs. Well, Orazio loves his daughter Artemisia, and he sees great possibilities for her as an artist. And at a very early age, he trained her, and he helped her develop herself as a very competent artist. And this she became. And she was allowed to work with the model, and she learned how to handle the human figure. And she was a very powerful designer, and actually became very famous in Europe and executed commissions all over Europe. This is her version of Susanna and the Elders. Her style is the new kind of realism that follows on the heels of the High Renaissance. The High Renaissance is Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raphael. I think most of you have heard of some of those people. And after the Reformation, the 16th century is a period of lots of strange, idiosyncratic, artistic behavior. Artists going off in lots of different directions. The Reformation caused a lot of doubt and confusion. I mean, it's part of a general breakup of that century. And at the end of the 16th century, there's a reform that takes place in painting. And one aspect of the Reformation is to go back to basics, to go back to nature. And so realism, at the beginning of the 17th century, emerges as a dominant style. And Rembrandt is a product of this realistic approach in the 17th century. And not to confuse it, but I'll mention the name Caravaggio. Caravaggio is the kind of genius, the sort of Picasso at the beginning of the 17th century, who turns art around and gets it back to working with real things. Well, Artemisia's Susanna and the Elders obviously identifies with the victim, with Susanna. And she doesn't necessarily come off as immediately as a heroine. But we obviously get involved in a woman who's undergoing a tremendous amount of torment. I mean, this is terrifying. This is terrible. This is horrible. This shouldn't happen to this person. And she gestures wildly, "Don't do this to me." And she says, "No, no, no, go away." And there are the two men, and they're whispering to each other. And whispering involves conspiracy. A whispering campaign to destroy people. We know that, not to drag Charles Colson into the dust, but Colson was involved in whispering campaigns to destroy the opposition. It's a technique used all the time. Start a rumor. Well, maybe they're talking about what they'll do to her if she doesn't comply with their wishes. And so you get this really powerful combination of these two men. And this one doesn't really look like an elder. He's about 36 or so. This man is more my age. I guess I'm starting to qualify as an elder. I don't like to admit it, but it's happening. But notice there's no water. We don't see the, we don't get involved in that whole tradition, that whole mythological tradition about Venus rising up from the sea. There's no symbolism about fertility or any of those kinds of things. We don't have a garden. There are no flowers suggesting the lushness of this erotic setting. But there's this very stark sort of Puritan setting of Susanna sitting against this very modest architectural wall with the men leaning over it. Furthermore, she doesn't make any effort to take a Mae West sort of semi-decent pose covering up herself with her fans. I mean, she's really exposed. And there's no doubt about that. There's no attempt to turn Susanna into the kind of image that we were talking about last night. She's very specific. And she's a naked figure. I don't know if you can see it, but Artemisia doesn't erase the wrinkles in her neck. There are little wrinkles over here in her elbow. There's a wrinkle in the groin. The stomach is almost starting to get flabby. The hair is disheveled. This is very stark and very realistic. This is something that's happening to a specific person. So this is the first time that this doesn't become an occasion for a voyeuristic act. I don't think there's any man that could feel nothing but sympathy for this woman and revulsion at the idea of these dirty, lecherous old men plotting to destroy this woman who won't play games with him today. So we don't have an image of the judgment. We don't have an image of the elders being stoned, but that will come later. So this mild seduction scene actually is a painting about rape. And we get involved with what is happening to this woman because of this violent act against her. And then here we get involved with her biography, and I think this is very interesting, but it's gruesome. At about Easter time in 1611, Artemisia was violently assaulted by a teacher. Her father, Orazio, had brought into the studio a man named Agostino Tassi to teach Artemisia perspective and perspective theory. He was a specialist in this area. And he had a friend who also came into the studio. I believe his name was Quori, Q-U-O-R-I. And all of this is recorded in the newspaper. You can still read the account of what happened at this moment. There was sexual harassment going on in the studio between these two men and this girl. And I don't think they called it that at that time. But sexual harassment is a very live issue today. I mean, we talk about it at school. We have clinics and workshops to tell us teachers what is sexual harassment, because maybe some of us are guilty of sexually harassing our students without even knowing it. There are all kinds of subtle ways that this is done. But in this case, it's not very subtle. And this sexual harassment ultimately led to Agostino assaulting Artemisia when she was alone. She was painting in the studio by herself, and she was violently assaulted. After the assault, Tassi is trying to smooth the waters, and he promises to marry Artemisia. And the tradition, the biblical tradition, and it's very much alive in the 17th century, is that if a woman is raped, she's spoiled, she's damaged goods, and she can only be related to the man who assaults her, and to nobody else. That tradition is still probably in the back of our minds, but I don't think it's as strong as it was in the 17th century. So Tassi understands this, and he promises to marry her. And what seems to have happened is that this promise resulted in subsequent sexual encounters between Tassi and this girl, who understands that she's no good for anybody else. And this goes on for a while, and suddenly Artemisia realizes that Tassi is a fraud and that she's been had. And so she tells her father, Orazio, what has happened to her. Orazio brings charges against Tassi. Tassi is brought to court. The trial lasts for 5 months. It's revealed that Tassi is guilty of incest and sodomy and adultery, and that he arranged for the murder of his own wife and other kinds of crimes. He generally is a man of ill repute. And he is sentenced to 8 months in prison, and gentle Artemisia is found innocent. However, Tassi is, at the end of 8 months, is acquitted, and the charges are dismissed. And for the rest of her life, Artemisia is known as a lascivious woman. She asked for it, and she got what she asked for. And her reputation as an amoral, precocious jet swinger, or whatever you want to call it, persists until 1987. I mean, if you pick up the history books, a man I respect very much, a critic from the New York Times, John Kennedy, who wrote a very powerful textbook called Mainstreams of Modern Art, wrote a book called The Lives of the Painters, and he describes Artemisia, describes this case, and there are innuendos in the way he describes the case that, again, she got what was coming to her. And he talks about how she became a very competent painter, but how her fame as a lover spread all over Europe. And the record is not really clear on that. It's a story that develops, that people persisted in telling over and over. Uncritically, there's a very prominent art historian, Witkower, who does the same thing. He says Tassi was a bad guy, but he ultimately was a very good painter, and he made up with Orazio. They got to be friends again, and they lived happily ever after. And then he goes on to describe Artemisia as this prolific painter, but also a prolific lover. So what happened to her continues. I mean, this is not just old dusty art history. This is modern commentary on something that happened in the past. And if you read the records, all of the court records, all of the newspapers, if you read your own testimonies, you come to the conclusion that there's been a monstrous mistake. And it's because of these kinds of things that people are starting to take a very critical look at art history, which is written by men who sometimes don't ask the right questions and continue to talk about these events keep these myths alive. Well, this is a self-portrait of Artemisia, and she uses this very realistic technique. See, I don't want to start describing her because I might get too involved in a lavish description of a lavish woman, and I might be guilty of doing the same things that Witkower and John Kennedy have been doing. I mean, she does look like a very powerful, strong, interesting individual. There's a kind of a wonderful intensity about her face. But let's just keep in mind that maybe all of this is true, that these things really did happen to her, that she is like Susanna, and that Susanna is an autobiographical painting, and that her life was destroyed by the vicious campaign of the elders. And She was not able to resist. She was physically overwhelmed. Susanna was able to resist. But I think she identifies with Susanna. Maybe she doesn't know it. Maybe she doesn't know she's a feminist. She doesn't know she's part of the women's movement, but she's been wronged. And she's compelled to do something about that. This is her signature down at the bottom in the drapery. You can see, you can get a little sense of the technique of the painting. There's this strong light and dark emphasis, but there's also a very rich color sense in these paintings. So the subject matter of the next few paintings deals with Judith and Holofernes, or Holofernes, the subject of Esther, who inaugurates the tradition of Purim in the Jewish world. Both of these women are involved in the liberation of their people. There is about to be a Holocaust, and these two heroic women do something to stop the impending destruction of their people. Judith arranges to become engaged to this king, this Persian king, who is about to inaugurate a Holocaust. And on their wedding night, she manages to get the king intoxicated. And before the marriage is consummated, she beheads the king. It's a very violent scene. While there is the suggestion here that in the Susanna and the Elders painting, there is the harassment and the anxiety and the terror and the indignity of what these men are doing to her, maybe these kinds of paintings can be interpreted autobiographically also as the culmination of that event, as a depiction of the violence that happened to Artemisia, but the violence that in a sense is implied with Susanna. And so we get these powerful images, and they seem like self-portraits, and this feels very much like the self-portrait that we just saw. This is Judith and her servant carrying the head of the king. It's not a very pleasant subject. It's in the Pitti Palace, a museum in Florence. There is an intensity here of this Judith, who she's the perpetrator of the violence, but it's something she's compelled to do. And I think we can also say it's the violence that is really done to her. She holds this sword that is the means of the execution. She's angry. I mean, she's rightfully angry. And she's also horrified by what's happened and by what she has done, by what she's been compelled to do, in a sense, to defend herself and her own people who are about to be physically violated. It's very convincing, I'm sure, in part because of the details. I mean, the reflections in the pearl and the ornament in the hair and all these things that appeal to the early Baroque artists as they investigated the visual world. And then there's the care with which he describes the sword and this scowling face on the end of the handle, sorry, I forget what you call that detail. But all those tiny little deep elements contribute to the nightmarish experience that she's painting. And the head of her husband to be being carried off in the middle of the night. Another version, and she works on the same theme several times. This is these are devices that become very stylistically very strong devices in the 17th century. The use of some light source which penetrates the darkness. This painting, in a sense, is like velvet painting. I'm sure you've all seen that being sold at the gas stations. They start with a dark canvas, and then they paint into the darkness the light. They work from dark to light. The Renaissance, I'm getting off the track here a little bit, but the Renaissance starts with a white canvas. The Renaissance starts with a conviction. In the beginning, there was light, and into the light comes darkness. And the 17th century really reverses that. It says, in the beginning, there was darkness, and into the darkness comes light. And the light barely reveals what's going on. And at the beginning of the 17th century, there's usually a light source within the painting. In the latter part of the 17th century, with a man like Rembrandt, the light comes from within. It's a spiritual light. It doesn't have a source outside. It's a divine presence within the people, the actors in the paintings. But here we get a source of light, and she hides it, the blinding light, from her face. And again, we have the sword, and they're carrying the head of the king away. So what the light does and what the darkness does is to subordinate parts to the whole and to emphasize certain important parts until they become excruciatingly unbearable in their intensity. The nose, the profile of Judith, the profile of this very handsome servant, the hand holding the knife, and then the rest is subordinate. But there's this very gruesome painting, which I should show right before we have our next gourmet meal. Judith cutting off the head of her husband. And it's very violent. I think her ideal, Caravaggio, would never show that kind of violence. His paintings were very violent, but there was never that kind of explicit detail. But if you believe this biography of Artemisia, and what happened to her as a kind of Susanna, and that's if you understand the violence that is being depicted here, which is also the violence that was heaped upon Artemisia, I think you can understand her need to destroy this man in the most bloody, violent fashion possible. So again, there's a strong suggestion that this is a self-portrait of Artemisia. And she's being assisted by that servant, forms those strong vertical lines. Artemisia has the diagonal action. The diagonal action is the thing that's really moving, and it's opposed to the angle of the leg, so you get this V-like form that brings all the lines and all the force of the painting down to the blood that's spurting out of the head. The draperies down below circle around that spot. It's a center, a focal point. There's no escaping it. So it's histrionic, it's overly dramatic, overly theatrical, but it's probably, I think, putting Artemisia on the psychologist's couch. It's necessary for her to go this far to rid herself of this demon of hate and anger because of what's happened to her. I like the servants in all these paintings. The servant is much more restrained. The central actor is much more violent. But the servant is a kind of nice moderator, mediator, which makes this thing almost palatable. But notice the blood spattering on the servant's arm. Notice the king's hand reaching up. It's closed. It's helpless. Judith is, well, I won't try to describe what her face is like. Well, these paintings that we've just seen were included in this exhibit, this really earth-shaking exhibit that happened in the 70s, surveying women painters from the 16th century to the present. And this painting also was included. The subject matter here is David and Bathsheba. And I think you understand the story. Bathsheba, again, is at the bath. David is across the street up there on the porch of that building, and he sees Bathsheba, and he lusts after Bathsheba. And Bathsheba is married to Uriah. Uriah is an officer in David's army. David forces himself upon Bathsheba. She becomes pregnant. David tries to arrange for Uriah to come back from the battle zone and to go to bed with his wife, but the tradition is that when one is at battle, one does not engage in intercourse, and Uriah doesn't do this. So Bathsheba is pregnant, and Uriah has been gone to war. So what can David do about it? And David arranges for Uriah to be sent to the front lines where he certainly will be killed, and he is killed. And Bathsheba's son is Absalom. And the story has all kinds of ramifications. And I don't know exactly how to connect it to Susanna, except that, again, the subject matter is a woman who, in a sense, becomes a victim of another person. And in this case, a wealthy, powerful person. And I don't know if she submitted simply because David was the king. But I'm sure that there's, again, it's difficult not to make some connections between Artemisia's personal life and the kinds of things that she painted. It's a very rich painting in terms of its color and in terms of its light and dark composition. Some of the details are exciting. This is the silver bowl painted with a great deal of care and love, with great visual intensity. And she really gets involved in that detail. And again, it's interesting to see how the light picks out certain forms and subordinates other forms. This is the beautiful Bathsheba being presented with pearls and diamonds against this lush, lavish landscape. It's sort of like the exotic garden in the Tintoretto painting. This is not Artemisia, this is her father, Orazio. And the subject matter is Danae. And again, it's one of these abduction scenes. This is Danae being showered with gold coins. And it is in a sense, another rape scene. And her father's treatment of the human figure is much more idealized. This is more of this fantasized, idealized nude figure. It doesn't have the specific details of Artemisia. Artemisia is much more realistic, but there's obviously a debt owed to her father, who loved this daughter dearly and who taught her things that he knew. This is the last painting that I'd like to show by Artemisia. This is Esther and I never can pronounce Ahasuerus' name. And it's a complicated story, which is carefully accounted for in the book of Esther. She is Jewish. She is taken into the harem of the king. The king doesn't know she's Jewish. Mordecai knows she's Jewish and finds out that the king's assistant would be like Ronald Reagan's assistant, Mr. Regan or Mr. Baker. The king's assistant is Naaman, who wants to destroy the Jewish people. And Esther manages to break a lot of rules and a lot of traditions and manages to let the king know about herself and her tribe and her Jewish origins, and that Haman wants to destroy her people and herself. And she argues with the king that if we were going to be sold into slavery, I wouldn't complain because I don't want to bother you, but when it means losing my life and the life of my people, I have to say something. And the king causes Haman to be executed. And the Feast of Purim, if I'm saying that word correctly, which is still celebrated today, is a celebration of the redemption of the people, the liberation of the people. And it together with the Judah theme, and the theme of David slaying Goliath, and the theme of Moses, and the plague of serpents, occupies the four corners of Michelangelo's Sistine Ceiling. And they're the four great liberation scenes of the Old Testament that point towards the final liberation scene, which is the death and resurrection of Christ. Well, I don't want to labor the point. I would say again that this subject is painted by Artemisia as a deeply felt, deeply personal kind of theme. She identifies with it. It becomes a part of her subjectivity. And she paints it with an unusual point of view from the perspective of a woman. And if we had my slide room here, again, we may, perhaps could find these themes painted by men. And I think we could sense that there's a there's a different approach. Artemisia really is unique. And I think from a 20th century perspective, we prize this very honest, kind of frank reporting. She really was, because of her biography, I think she was a person who had a perspective on things, who stood apart and was able to liberate herself, in a sense, from the bondage of the traditional ways of talking about these subjects. Rich was talking about this yesterday in his presentation on the language of the church and getting bogged down in all this garbage of traditional symbols that we use over and over again. He was explaining that to become a Christian artist, all you have to do is learn how to make rainbows and butterflies and a couple of other forms, and then you've got the vocabulary of the Christian artist. Well, it takes more than that. It takes a profound person who's able to take these experiences of the 20th century, of 1987, and wed them together or play them against centuries of traditions, to take their own biography, a violated woman who was harshly treated, to take the craft of painting, drawing, design, perspective, light and dark, and to put all these things in the washing machine or the mixer and mix them up, and something comes out that's quite precious and unique, and it's a new point of view. Well, she did get married. Her father helped her arrange a marriage with a Florentine man. Her honor, to some extent, was salvaged. She did receive commissions. Her father traveled around Europe, and they painted in several courts. And she assisted him and also did a lot of work on her own. But she ends up in the art history books as this nifty lady dashing around the courts of Europe, having love affairs. And it doesn't seem that that's really true.
Around the time of the Reformation?
Oh, they are indeed. I think part of the Reformation, at least in the Protestant world, is a reaction against the excesses of some of these kinds of paintings. Except that it went too far. And, for example, in the Dutch Reformed Church, you smash the windows and throw everything out and whitewash it, and things become extremely simple. I don't think that Martin Luther ever really meant to abandon his rich Catholic tradition, but it happened through his followers. The one thing that remained is music, which he very much enjoyed. But I guess I don't know enough about Luther to know how much he was involved in the visual arts. I don't know. Rich, do you know anything about that?
Some of the artists that were related to Luther were Cranach and Dürer. One actually illustrated Luther's catechism, and Dürer supported Luther's work and illustrated a number of his pamphlets. Dürer's main resource was Italian art. And in fact, one of the illustrations of one of Luther's pamphlets was a Dürer, Adam and Eve, on either side of the tree with the serpent wrapped around the center of it. And Dürer got this Adam and Eve from Mantegna. So it's almost a direct continuation of the Italian. And there was no comment by Luther that this rather lush representation of the human form, male and female, was abhorrent to him at all, but very appropriate to what he was trying to say.
Everything about him suggests that he was a very human very human human. I mean, a passionate, lusty, hungry man. And I've been being sort of a prude here in my comments. And I don't mean to dismiss all of this from a prudish point of view. Certainly the human body and the sexual appetite and all of these kinds of things are gifts from God. And it's And there are, but there are, and there are some people like Rembrandt who were able to celebrate this in very positive ways, and Durer, who's just mentioned. Oh. But then, as I've been trying to show, that it's also that there's the possibility of these gifts being distorted and destroyed. So I would guess that maybe the Lutheran attitude today is a complex issue that comes from our Puritan traditions, from all kinds of reactions against the excesses of previous ages. I don't know if we can pin anything specifically on Luther.
Well, it may be that you commented, Brett commented a little in his book, Table Talks, in which he comments about all kinds of secular subjects. Maybe in there, I haven't read all Table Talks yet.
Well, there's celebration of the secular world as well as admonitions for care and proper perspective.
But he must have condemned rape and all those things.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if he valued the artistry of the paintings of that time, that's what I'm curious about.
I don't know if there was a direct relationship between Durer and Luther. I suspect that would be dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Luther was an outlaw, and Durer actually was in the Catholic Church, but he was an admirer of Luther. But I don't know if the connection would be explicit.
You got there's a political problem, because the center of art at the time is Italy. A lot of people say they didn't even have a Renaissance in Germany, that they went right from the Gothic to the Baroque, so that any kind of struggle that you would have with Rome would also be a struggle that you would have with Italian art in general, mm-hmm. and with the whole culture.
Yes.
So I think Durer, Luther probably preferred to stay within a rather medieval tradition in his love of art, which he did have, rather than to pick up on the Caravaggio and the lush figurative stuff that was coming out of Italy.
The first part of the 17th century belongs to Rome, but the second part of the 17th century belongs to rising nationalism, and people try desperately to get away from the dominance of Rome. And as they start to discover themselves, and this realistic painting technique helps them to see what's unique about their own backyard. So you get the emergence of Dutch art and French art and German art. And that's really modern art as we know it today. I think the one theme I was trying to underline, we're all decent people, sinless, blameless, and we're all very humble, and I'm the most humble of you all. But we're all walking around here slamming Tammy and what's his name, Jim, this week. The bakers. We're all involved in smearing them, and maybe all the facts aren't in. You know, I think we all have reservations about the electronic ministry, but we're all engaged in condemning these people, and we hope they lose their shirt. And they never get it back. And in some ways, I guess we're repeating what happened to Susanna and to Artemisia. And I just feel strongly that Artemisia is talking about some issues and values and postures and positions that are about things that are still happening. It happens every day in the newspaper. And we just, I guess I'm being a preacher here, asking us to take these things very seriously. They're not just things that happened way back there. Artists have always told the truth. I mean, the good artists that remain to the present are really involved in telling the truth, and the truth should be listened to and looked at and pondered. They all had good perspectives, and they did represent their society. And I think some of them, like last night I was talking about Bouguereau, had that strange painting about the nymphs dragging the man off into the woods. But I suppose in a sense that was truth too, because that's what men really believed, that women were all after the men and they wanted to drag them off into the woods. But I think all of these works have a lot to tell us. And I have been antagonistic about the women's reformation in the 80s. But I'm not anymore, and I think there's a lot of work to do there. There are a lot of things to go back and look at and ask questions about. There are a lot of textbooks that need to be rewritten. There are whole perspectives that just are not there. There's this sacred canon of people we always talk about. We always talk about Michelangelo and Raphael and Leonardo. We don't talk about quilt makers. That silly women's activity that's not important, not worth talking about. There are all kinds of things like that that need to be reevaluated and brought back onto the table. I guess that's one of the wonderful things that's happening today. It's irritating to hear Barbara Rossing stand up there at Vespers and say we're going to use inclusive language, and if you like, you may pray to our Mother in Heaven, hallowed be your name. And that's hard for me to do, but I also believe in it as part of this healing that has to go on. This sort of enlargement of our perspectives. And at the end of the 20th century, it's time to take a critical look at a lot of our sacred traditions. Maybe not throw out the baby with the bathwater, but almost. Last night said, she was really upset that you had to know something in order to look at paintings. I think a lot of people have that attitude that just because I can see something, I should be able to get what's there. But a work of art is what bubbles up from a large community, from the whole structure of values and motivations, the whole wiring diagram, complex diagram of a world.